Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 316 of the Morning Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California. Oh. We also have Jaime Lopez Jr. on the line in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
All righty, it's going good. Let's see, just quick fact check. I was talking about floppies last week. Again, we're talking about the 3.5-inch floppy disks, and that's kind of what I started with because I actually started with a Mac. Was my first sort of main computer, even though I did use Commodores and stuff before that. But day to day and day in and day out. I mentioned the high density floppies at 800 kilobytes, which is wrong because it was actually 1.44 megabytes was the high density disks. The disks originally, the floppy disks originally, or they weren't really floppy, but the 3.5 inch floppies were originally 360 kilobytes or 720 kilobytes. But on the Mac, because we had, I don't know, we didn't have as much overhead, we would get 400 kilobytes and 800 kilobytes of space, right? And then the double density ones were, or the high density ones were 1.4 megabytes. Anyway,
and they were actually floppy. The reason they're called floppy is because, well,
the five and a quarters were, right?
Yeah, but even the 3.5s, the actual medium,
the disk itself was
this piece of kind of plasticish magnetic plastic film. It was, yeah.
You were writing on rust. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that part was floppy.
It was like cellophane or whatever with rust. Yeah.
But with the 3.5 inches, they put them inside of a hard shell case, essentially, whereas the 5.25 ones were in kind of like a nylon case.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And an old joke from one of our Mac user groups, I don't know if you remember Mac user groups, but we were talking about viruses once, and one of the guys said, what, you take the little plastic sleeve off your floppies? Those little plastic, never mind. All right. That's like a dad joke. You're just supposed to groan. Yep. Alrighty. We'll start off with follow-up with Mark.
Yeah, so we talked a couple of times, I think, about the fact that ARM, which is the company that makes the IP that Apple is using for the Apple Silicon, so they make the design, essentially, of the microprocessor that all sorts of companies can lease and use to build their own chips. We talked a while back about them. The rumor was that they were shopping themselves to be acquired, and it looks like that's actually happening. So NVIDIA is buying ARM for $40 billion, which is pretty amazing, pretty high price, buying it actually from current owners, which are SoftBank, the Japanese bank. So this is kind of interesting. I don't think it will have any real immediate effects on Apple or other companies, because I think it would be kind of crazy for NVIDIA to, if they tried to shut down that business, it would just be, it would be a disaster for the industry, for one thing. And they must be, they'd lose all of the revenue that ARM is generating right now. So I don't think that's the idea that they're behind them buying this. I think they probably think they can make a good business out of it. So, yeah.
So in 9 to 5 Mac, fact, I also posted a link here for that same story. But they do sort of look a little deeper into the Apple thing, and they mentioned that Apple and Nvidia have had a rocky road for the last little while. Nvidia says that Arm will continue to operate its open license model while maintaining a global customer neutrality, and has been the foundation of its success. Which is to say that, you know, they're not going to like Apple licenses the design, right? From ARM, right?
Right.
I think we talked about this before, that ARM doesn't actually make chips per se, right?
That's so correct. And neither does NVIDIA, for that matter.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't make chips? But they're like a graphics card people, aren't they? The ones that made the graphics accelerators?
Right. But all their silicon is made overseas in a foundry.
Okay. Okay. Are they the California company, NVIDIA?
They are. Yeah, they're right up the street from where I live, as a matter of fact.
There you go.
Yeah, basically at the corner of San Tomas Expressway and Central Expressway, you know, the Bay Area. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. That's that. And then so we're off to Harmy for some App Store updates.
Yeah, the App Store review guidelines have been updated, and very nicely. You don't need to use one of those fancy pants diffing mechanisms that we've linked to in this show's history. Apple did us a solid and said, here are the changes. And I don't know if you guys read through any of these, but you can just pick some interesting ones in no random order. In any random order would be what I went to say there. So of course you'd expect things like, for new features like app clips, widgets, extensions, notifications, that's described in 2.5.16. Scrolling way down, there are clarifications. 2.3.1, don't include any hidden, dormant, or undocumented features in your app. Your app's functionality should be clear to end users and app review, which is a little clarification there for, something of an epic nature. and then there's some around another sort of interesting battle they've had, 4.9. Streaming games are permitted so long as they adhere to all guidelines. For example, each game update must be submitted for review. Developers must provide appropriate metadata for search. Games must use in-app purchase to unlock features, functionality, etc. Of course, there is always the open internet, and web browser apps reach all users outside of the App Store. And related to that are 4.9.1 and 4.9.2 that basically say, here is something you could technically do if you wanted to offer a streaming game service. Thinking of something like Google Stadia or Microsoft's xCloud. These are wildly unreasonable guidelines. To be clear, this is, until legislators make it illegal to do so, or courts decide that it is, against the law to do so. It's their store. They can go by their rules. But for me, I'm like, wow, like there's just no way you could have every game that would be available through something like Microsoft xCloud, one, go through App Store review, because like there's yet another sort of policy. Like there is some sort of review that Microsoft goes through. So as a game developer, you'd have to go through another potentially contradictory, store review. And sort of another thing on there is like, well, they don't do that with Netflix content, right? Is anybody aware of Netflix's, flirting with, pedophilic content, or at least getting very, very close to it? Is Apple going to review all new series and documentaries and movies submitted to Netflix? Because given what Netflix did, maybe they should. I say that facetiously, but using it as an example of like, this wouldn't hold for other streaming type of content. Why are games so treated uniquely here? And we can argue sort of back and forth about the why, but it's like, well, when you really tear into it, these are like very unreasonable guidelines to have around streaming games. Although I do admit that, like, as far as I know, it seems like it's totally okay for Apple to decide that, right? If they decided every app icon must be orange, I mean, dude, that's their store. They can make it, get your designer to come up with a pleasant orange that sticks out from the crowd, right? It's kind of interesting to read these.
Yeah, it's interesting that I noticed too that there's another one about games offering a streaming game service subscription must be downloaded directly from the Apple Store, which is kind of a similar thing. So, just looking ahead, did you actually add that story that you posted in the Slack channel today about Epic and Apple, that we didn't start the fire one?
No, I didn't add that in there. That was a cheeky comment that I made in the Friends of the Show channel.
Since you brought up Epic, I want to circle back to Slack and talk about that one. It's in the Friends of the Show channel, Mark, if you're looking for it.
Yeah, I saw it.
So what I got out of that was that Apple was saying that we didn't start this fight. Epic basically just decided to fight Apple, like, rather than dealing with the review guidelines. We've all had this where something gets rejected for whatever reason. You grumble, you know, you go check the resolution guide, you know, you might complain or send them an email or whatever. But in this case, it sounds like Epic, you know, kind of just decided to pick a fight with the bear, right? They say don't poke the bear, right? And Apple's like, we didn't start this, and this is, you know, they could totally fix this problem themselves. And also point out that Apple points out that that Epic or Apple's iOS is a small part of Epic's business, right? So it's like, why are they even bothering to pick this fight? You know, is it just to make points? And they also, I don't know if they were being facetious too, but they pointed out that at the time that this started, Epic's Fortnite was waning a little bit. And I think they're saying that possibly by picking this fight with Apple, they're getting some notoriety in the marketplace. And, you know, like all of a sudden it's kind of like free publicity, you know, because they're picking a fight with Apple. But I don't know if you guys got that out of this article that I may post it from The Verge, by the way, for those of you driving at home. What do you think?
I mean, I think Apple's right. They did start it. You know, they knew the rules. They've been following the rules for years, and they suddenly decided to disobey the rules. So what do they expect to happen?
Yeah. And so rather than like the rest of us, you know, who either change our feature or take out that, like, I think they said they could take out one thing in the app, and they would have, then Apple would have accepted them. And he said, it's not that they've been kicked out of the store. It's just that they, you know, they broke the contract and now they're out of the store like the rest of us would be.
Yeah.
And they just have to reverse whatever change they made that upset, that Apple said was against the rules, and they'd be back in the store. There's no point in like going to a judge or jury, since you brought it up, Jaime, you know? Is that what you meant by when you said going to courts and stuff?
Yeah, so the quote that that I read, and I'll point out here that if folks want the context, you know, join the Friends of the Show channel on our Slack. Quoting here from Apple, Epic started a fire and poured gasoline on it and now asks this court for emergency assistance in putting it out, even though Epic can do so itself in an instant by simply adhering to the contractual terms that have profitably governed its relationship with Apple for years. This court was right when it previously ruled that self-inflicted wounds are not irreparable injury, which I thought was, pun intended, a sick burn that made me think of the Billy Joel song, "We Didn't Start the Fire." So we didn't start the fire. It was always burning since the world's been turning. We didn't start the fire. No, we didn't light it, but we tried to fight it, were the cheeky lyrics that I decided to quote when I posted in the Slack there. That it's like, you know, that it's kind of unusual to see Apple come out and be more than just big corporation with, you know, expensive lawyers that mm-hmm. that say a lot but don't really say anything at all. And in this case, they had a Johnny Cochran-esque sort of level of making it very concrete of, this is our opinion of what you're doing, to both, you know, the court and their opponent. It's kind of unusual to see Apple do that sort of thing, which is notable and interesting. And it tying it back to these review guidelines, I think that's why some of these things are in here about, like, you know, how strictly can they follow the don't include any hidden, dormant, or undocumented features mm-hmm. in your app, right? Like, just about every non-trivial app does that. You've got A/B testing, you've got... we're not really sure if this feature is ready to roll. We'll put it out there, and if it looks good, we'll turn it on for everybody. Otherwise, just our mm-hmm. employees will use it. Like, there's all sorts of ways that are not nefarious and not looking to pick a public battle with Apple that you could run afoul of if you were to read this, you know, strictly as like a lawyer sort of thing.
There are lots of stories though about apps that have features that got turned on after review. I mean, there was I think a couple of years ago we talked about some guy who had this framework that would enable features after your app was in, passed through Apple's store. You know, you go in and flip a switch and enable a feature that wasn't, you know, present when it was going through review, like some new feature or some gizmo. But yeah, so we've seen that before, you know. And I think there was a talk done by one of the guys who was one of the original App Store review heads, talking about, you know, we talked about this before, where you know, they'll put in like Cupertino IPs or looking for specific IPs that belong to Apple and you know, hide features behind them, you know. And some of them are dumb enough to put, like, you know, put Cupertino in the name of the function or method. And, you know, obviously they got busted good by doing that, you know?
Yeah, or geofence around Apple's headquarters.
Geofencing, yeah. Yeah, yeah, geofencing. Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Yeah, there's something else about the article. Anyway, I can't remember what it is, so maybe it'll come back to me later.
A couple of other ones. One of them, 322 VI. Was this not already one? Apps should not require users to rate the app, review the app, watch videos, download other apps, et cetera, to, you know, in order to access functionality, use the app, receive monetary or other compensation. Like, wasn't that already a thing that you weren't allowed to do? Is this one?
Yeah, I think that was sort of an unwritten thing. You couldn't like harass people to, but I mean, we've always had that rate mechanism thing in there, and I think it annoyed people, right? I think mm-hmm, a lot of mm-hmm. times, because we've talked about that. We talked about that almost in our first year about how to properly, you know, ask for ratings, not to do it on the first launch or like, you know, second launch, whatever, but like, you know, give it some time, let them create a number of records or something like that, and then politely ask them to review you, you know? But yeah, I think that maybe it wasn't clearly stated enough or stated clearly enough for people to really get that, right? So,
well, this is taking it to a whole other level. They're saying that you can't do things like, hey, you want to get a free level of this game? Well, rate it, and then you get that free level. You can't do things like that.
No, I mean, that you're right. That does sound like a whole other level, but they wouldn't have come up, would they have come up with this on their own, or they have they run across this in,
oh, I'm sure they
in
have.
Other apps in the store,
yeah,
right?
I'm sure they have.
One of the ones that scares me that apparently they've run across is 322X. Apps offering personal loans must clearly and conspicuously disclose all loan terms, including but not limited to equivalent maximum annual percentage rate, APR, and payment due date. Apps may not charge a maximum APR higher than 36%, including costs and fees, and may not require repayment in full in 60 days or less. That sounds like a payday loan or something. Are there payday loan apps or something?
I guess so.
Thank heavens I've not run across these.
So you can charge a minimum APR higher than 36%, though?
Our APR starts from 37% and goes up to 1,000%.
I guess the implication is that the absolute maximum is 100%. So if your minimum is higher than 36%, then your maximum is also higher than 36%.
Hey, math guy.
Yeah, although really weird. I guess there's no real fundamental reason that the APR has to be lower than 100%, though. Yeah, that's a weird way they wrote it. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure what they're aiming for is these variable rates, right? Where they can jump up based on, you know, you miss a payment or something and your rate jumps up, like a credit card does that sometimes. So they're saying that if you have some kind of variable rate and your maximum APR is higher than 36, that's prohibited. But it does seem to have a loophole that you could have a minimum rate higher than 37% and then you're fine.
This is an interesting one. All new features, functionality, and product changes must be described specifically in the notes for review section of the App Store content. Like, is that really something we've had to do in the past or would should do? I mean, like, you know, like if you just add a new, like if I add, like, you know, I don't know, locations to Disk Tracker, all of a sudden, is that like something I have to disclose?
So generic descriptions will be rejected. That's interesting.
Yeah. And accessible for review, it says here too, I guess. So Apple has to be able to test it.
We'll see what happens with those. You know, every 2 weeks we release a new app and bring you fun new stuff and fix bugs that everybody uses when they don't want to add actual real App Store review sections.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, like, you know, like some apps might just roll out a new feature or change a feature. Do they need to tell Apple that, I guess? I don't know. Weird. Should we move on?
Sure. We've got the link in the show notes for those of you driving at home. Go take a look at those updates, see if anything applies to you.
This next article, and of course, is from Gordon Kelly. I think that's one of our favorite people, Mark, if I'm not mistaken. Is it one of our favorite people?
He doesn't seem to like Apple very much.
No. But anyway, he's just talking about how the iPhone, well, this isn't old news now. Like that the iPhone 12 launch is now officially late, but then Apple already said that it was going to be late, so it's kind of like not really, it's kind of like fake news or not really news. I think that some people were expecting that there might be a phone announced, but I think we all were pretty clear that we didn't think it was going to be an iPhone this last event announcement. And you know, it's no surprise that they're doing this, but I think, what did he say in the article here? Something about releases revealed. When are they being released? That they won't be part of the event. And, oh yes, a newly renamed 6.1-inch iPhone 12 Plus. I guess that's new, right? And the 6.1 iPhone 12 Pro. Those are new announcements, I guess. from this article. And that's the iPhone 12 so far.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that this newer rumor that I'd seen elsewhere that like maybe they'll have the iPhone event on the 30th. It didn't say when the devices themselves would be available. That would be nice because I am hoping to get a new phone. So I definitely want to hear about it and get myself all excited.
Along with the iOS 15 release, because that'll give us plenty of time to make sure our apps are working fine.
We released it yesterday. It's already downloaded to your phones.
Yeah.
It's about to reboot and install itself.
What, you didn't test it?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And the next story here is that about the sad news, or possibly sad news, about the MacBook Air. Evan Spence, again from Forbes, is predicting or writing that with the introduction of the A14X to start next month, and Apple moving towards ARM-based Macs, that the MacBook Air might get left behind in terms of a format or a size. And this is what you talked about yesterday with the 5-nanometer wafer. That's not the size of the... that was the big small number that they talked about yesterday, right, Mark? The 5-nanometer transistors?
Yeah, so 5-nanometer is... Well, so they used to talk about transistor technologies by the size of the polysilicon gate that patterns the size of the transistor. So when they said, you know, like a 1-micron technology or, 250 nanometer technology, something like that, it used to be the transistor size, but it's moved on from that. It's now, this is getting into the inside baseball, into the weeds, but it's now the pitch of the first metal layer, because that's actually a lot smaller than the transistor in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it's basically the size of the metal line, essentially.
Yeah, so you're saying here that in looking at the marketing that they've done with the Intel powered stuff is one thing, but as he says, if you look at the YouTube page, scroll down to the bottom, you'll not find the MacBook Pro or the MacBook Air in the offerings there. So I don't know if that really means that they're going to drop this stuff, but maybe
rumors.
It's just the name Air is just going to go away. Who knows?
Yeah,
right.
More clickbait.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is that I think I pointed out is that I went back to a MacBook Pro 13 after many years of using Airs, because they're effectively the same size, right? But I get more oomph with the Pro, right? So yeah, so it's kind of like, and like, you know, the difference between like a 17 when the Air came out, you had the 17 inch cafeteria tray, right, Mac, and it was huge and heavy and whatever, right? So and then the 15 came out shortly after, like the 15 that we now know as the MacBook Pro, right? But the 13 Pro is so much smaller now that it practically is a MacBook Air for all intents and purposes. Is right. In fact, it's smaller than my 2013 MacBook Air. So yeah, okay. Move on. So I posted this story here from Pete Steinberger, a review of what he calls the state of SwiftUI, and he's gone through an example he uses to sort of pick apart SwiftUI where we are today, and that's based on what we've had last year and what we saw come out of WWDC. Is he's taken the Fruta app that Apple provided, which is built on multiple platforms. It runs on iOS, iPadOS, and macOS, and you can play around with it. And he's gone through and looked at some of the things that happened, crashes that happened based on the different architectures and that kind of stuff. I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at this, but looking at the way that, you know, some of the things work on Mac side and how they work on iPad and iOS, quite a bit different. So, and he's looked at the performance of the build, basically the timing and that kind of stuff with the SwiftUI. Can't remember anything that stuck out, but he was just sort of saying, like, if you're looking at iOS 14 and that's your target thing, then if you're sort of a hobbyist or you have individual screens in your app, then SwiftUI works pretty well. But yeah, he's finding that if you have multiple screens and, you know, pushing use different view model kind of things, you'll have trouble with using just pure SwiftUI. So I think it's a mix and match sort of thing. Do you guys have a chance to look at this article?
At it now. It's not too shocking. I mean, it's still new technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Apple's always had issues like this. I remember a classic example is when Core Data first came out back in, what was it, iPhone OS 3 or was it 4? Mm-hmm. 3. There was this crash that was a completely repeatable, obviously an Apple bug, of it would crash when you, I forget now what it was, but when you add or remove a cell in your fetch results control or something like that. So it was, you know, it was in all their sample code. And I remember that one of the big, the famous textbooks at the time had the solution for it. published in their book, and it was like a 4-page long thing of just all these.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of nuts, but yeah, but that was just because there was this major bug in the library, and it took them, you know, until the next version a year later to solve it. So I'm not too surprised, I guess, that this kind of stuff is happening.
When I read this, I wanted to sort of separate out a couple different things, going along with Mark's notion that I do agree that it's still fairly early as a technology. I do think some of the things they point out are an unfortunate side effect of how sort of Apple had to approach this, right? Where they couldn't completely replace everything in UIKit and AppKit at the same time. That's just a lot of surface area to replace, right? Mm-hmm. And they gave us this thing that, you know, you can wrap UIKit and AppKit, and it seems that not only was that useful for app developers, but was also useful for Apple itself. We're like, all right, well, how are we going to implement this thing? It's like, well, we can offer it, but we can't have it, you know, be completely rewritten. All right, well, we'll wrap it ourselves then, right? And I think they're running into weirdo issues where the mechanism that Swift UI is trying to use to make things declarative doesn't really work, you know, 100% of the time well with a completely different abstraction in UIKit and or AppKit that is trying to be very, very stateful. And it's juggling to do that sort of thing. I've written code that has to bridge these two very, very foreign concepts and somehow pretend that they're the same concept, and stuff falls through. Like, you know, they're pointing out here with these Swift UI attribute graph crashes or these platform binding crashes. I'm like, yeah, I didn't write exactly this sort of thing. I've written other things that were trying to take the best of both worlds and ended up with sort of a muddy middle. So I think that's one sort of approach that I look to take of like, well, you know, how serious of a problem is this? And then the other thing that I think is getting sort of tossed in here that I don't think is, strictly speaking, appropriately indicative of the state of Swift UI. It could be, but I'm caveating that the devil's advocate says, well, there could be other reasons here, is the Fruta example, right? The example app that they're doing. I give Apple kudos that they actually were doing something that has been something I've asked for several years, right? Of like, oh, it's cool to do these one-off, you know, one-pager view control. Everything is in the massive view controller just to show the example thing, but it would be kind of nice to show people, how are you going to build a larger non-trivial app to do something? So I give them credit for doing that with the Fruit app, because it's much more useful as an app in and of itself to sort of explain how you can do things. With that said, I'd have to imagine that there are challenges in doing such a thing where normally Apple groups don't work together, right? We're very used to hearing from people like, oh yeah, like it's very siloed, and very few people have the cross thing. So I bet you pieces were sort of agreed upon, and then like everybody throw their Lego bricks at the wall and let's hope they all kind of stick together, right? I would imagine that might have happened. And I could also imagine that they had to ride the wave of what's in or out of scope for, you know, what's going to actually be released. And oops, it turns out we probably shouldn't have included this one part, because that was always kind of like, you know, a questionable part of like, will it be in or out of scope? And that might have attributed to some of the development problems, if that makes sense. Where, you know, it wasn't like their main priority was get this example app out the door. The main priority was get this operating systems out the door. That's what I'm getting at. Yeah. So getting stretched a little thin might have, you know, contributed to this factor.
But I think it's cool though that sort of forward thinking that Apple has sort of solved or trying to solve the AppKit versus UIKit problem that we've been sort of circling around for the last number of years, you know, by having Catalyst and by having Swift UI, they're now trying to find a way to have a, you know, a set of frameworks and stuff like that work across platforms, multiple platforms, right? And that may all sort of lead towards even moving the Mac over to ARM, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, but like I find the iPad pretty snappy when it comes to loading apps and loading files and things like that. You know, there's, you know, you don't get the beach balls of death, you know, kind of spiraling out of control all day long, which you do with the Mac, even to this day on the fastest Mac, right? So I think that Swift UI is giving them a chance to sort of, you know, rewrite things. I mean, we've been talking about this for a while in that, you know, when Swift came out, we had all these Objective-C, you know, frameworks and shoring up the whole operating systems on all three platforms. And you know, so we all begged for a native version of UIKit. Well, here we go, right? Apple's coming to the table with such a thing in the shape of Swift UI, right? And that also opens up the ability for those of us who've been spending our time in iOS to start thinking about the Mac because of Catalyst and because of the Swift UI, you know, the fact that the language runs across, you know, all the platforms, right? And you don't have to go off and study AppKit in detail kind of thing, right? And the change and the differences and changes, because, I mean, the Mac as a platform, it has a pretty deep, dark basement and a weirdly weird attic above it, you know, sort of, and you sort of have to go and figure out what those strange things that are left over from, like, you know, probably the 80s in there, right? iOS is a bit newer in terms of a language and sort of a platform, but you know, and then Objective-C, you know, sort of dragging that along, it's like dragging along a big shipping trunk or ship, what do you call it, shipping containers full of old baggage, right? So I think it bodes well for where we're going with developing on the Apple platforms, right?
I do, because even though I see room for improvement in their, you know, building in a more fully featured example app that cohesively brings together what WWDC is trying to show you, it's a lot better. Let me tell you, I've in years past, you know, gone through some of their examples and said to myself, the person who wrote this, was this literally the first app that they ever wrote? Because it's not doing a very good job of teaching me these concepts, and sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes I'm like, yeah, I definitely wouldn't have done that way as a software engineer, and it might very well have been, right? Maybe, you know, this is a positive sign is what I'm trying to caveat this. So, like, it's presented very negatively in Peter Steinberger's blog here, and I'm not, you know, discounting the, like, yeah, it would be nice if, you know, it didn't crash on macOS. It would be nice if the UI stuff didn't, as he says, jump around sometimes, or sorry, I should say views get misaligned. I'm like, well, I've seen worse, and not with new technology either. It was like, hey, here's this very basic thing. Oh, you know, that was like the intern's first time writing an app, or maybe it was a very experienced engineer, but they were very experienced at like core audio or something. I had no idea how to write an app. And somebody said, hey, go write an app that uses the thing you just built. Oh, okay, let me cobble it together. Like, this, it's unfortunate. It happens. I think this is better than what we had before, which wasn't nothing, but sometimes was. And there is still room for improvement. So I give them a C plus in this area, grading on this, if I were to grade one. Just so folks don't think, I think when I first read this this post, I thought, like, man, this is kind of an F. And I said, no, actually, let me think about this. I think it's more like a C. It's not, you know,
C or C minus. Yeah.
Yeah, it's still a passing grade, I think, for where Swift UI is. And that does mean that there are, there be dragons, right? You got to be real careful if you're going to invest in Swift UI and make sure you know what you're taking on there. They call it the bleeding edge because you bleed when you're on it.
Yeah. I mean, there are some speed bumps. I was working on some stuff last week where I was doing a demo on disclosure groups, and you know, like, basically they're taking the little triangle thing that we have on the Mac, you know, where you click on the triangle and it turns points down and discloses some hidden content, right? That's now come over to iOS, and one thing I found was trying to get the, so you click on the row, but depending on where you put the toggle to click the row, didn't quite work correctly, but it was in the order in which I was making the calls in Swift UI, and that's totally not clear. Like how would you even think to change the order of the modifiers that you're putting in there? Like, you just think, hey, I'm putting padding on, hey, I'm putting a font on, hey, I'm putting a frame in, you know. Why would one thing before the other make a difference? And it does, but that's just, I think it's the nature of how new this whole language is, right? So just weird things like that happen to, you know, as you work on it. And it's, I mean, I was talking to a colleague the other day, and he was complaining about, you know, or saying that Swift UI is buggy, and he was trying to do some navigation stuff with the navigation stack, you know, with the navigation link and that kind of stuff. And those are, they're just, they don't behave the same way that, you know, your conventional navigation stack works, right, in iOS, right? That's just a different metaphor and a different way of approaching it. And it's odd things, like, you know, where you put a space affects how the code compiles and runs and things like that, right? So it's just odd. It's sort of a, I guess it's trying to learn a new language as well, right? Anyway, let's move on on to the Apple event, because we have a lot to cover here. Well, we have a lot to cover. We have a lot to not cover, right? Mark and I watched it live, and Jaime, you were saying you were working, so you recapped it, right? So do you want to lead in there?
Yeah. I guess, spoilers, there were no phones at this event, which is, I think, something that we had talked about in the show, that we kind of didn't expect that to be the case anyway. So this was pretty much about the watch, or watches, and iPad, or iPads, and a couple other things that were thrown in there. So let's start things off. So the Apple Watch Series 6, that is the premier model of Apple Watch, one of the key things it gets is blood oxygen monitoring. So continuing along the same lines of doing more and more health-related stuff, got an oxygen sensor in there, which is neat.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially in the case of the current time, I mean, that's one of the problems with COVID. If you get symptoms, is your O2 levels can become a question. So it's kind of interesting that they chose that as, I mean, notwithstanding it's sort of good for health and all that kind of stuff, but it also is timely that it also is able to do that in our current circumstance, where you want to measure your O2 levels, your O2 saturation, to basically make sure that you're actually able to process the air you're breathing in, right? You know?
Yeah. It is really good timing, because I'd have to imagine they didn't like see COVID happening and it's like, do we have oxygen sensors? Good. Duct tape them into the current watch and call it good.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Well, they must have been forward looking. I mean, like, they talk about the people who, in fact, they even shouted out U of T here in Toronto as one of the people working on the blood saturation and pulse oximetry, they called it, right? And the fact that, you know, they're doing some background tasking as well, so you don't have to necessarily be, you know, it'll be constantly monitoring you, kind of thing. But it was a pretty interesting feature.
Yeah. Apparently their latest Apple Silicon based system on a chip gives them enough headroom where they can have a brighter watch face for the always on watch face, so continuing with that, so that's nice. They've got
and the always on elevation too,
that was the altimeter too. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's interesting as a sensor to have in there. As I'm sitting here at my desk, it's like, let me see, is it exactly the same altitude? What's happening? You know,
how many flights of stairs have I climbed today? Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know if they talked about this at this time in the event, but I thought it was a little curious that they had the loop, the sync. Like, if you said, you know what, it's just too much of a hassle to use a clasp. What if I just had a perfectly shaped loop that I could put my wrist through? I was like, oh, okay. Kind of wonder how they're going to end up sizing those appropriately.
But they had a whole slide of different sizes. Like, you know, did you see that? Like, they had like 10 or something different sizes.
Do you know which size you would be? I was like,
I have no idea.
If they gave me something I could compare to my current band, and I could say, all right, well, I'm, you know, usually on position 4, and sometimes as low as position 3.
Well, you can always measure the diameter of your wrist, right? And that will tell you.
Yeah.
Right? As long as it's a little forgiving, right? Like, so one thing I've noticed with my watch is that usually after I've just gotten out of the shower, I tend to like hotter showers. I bloat up. I fluff up a little bit. Yeah. And I'm like, we're going to have to open it up one notch higher.
Really?
And then as my body cools off, it's like, okay, put it back down to the 4th position that I normally use. And sometimes in the winter, it's down to the 3rd position, right? Yeah. Like my body, you know, constricts. There's just, you know, blood and heat and all that stuff is affects things. I'm like, well, how forgiving is this single loop? Because I'm going to be like, yeah,
it's liquid silicone. It's going to be stretchy, right? It's liquid silicone, so it's going to have to stretch over your wrist. I remember when the watch first came out, Felix and I went to the Apple store in Ottawa on our way to Chateau Montebello, and was it Ottawa or Quebec City, maybe? I don't know. One of those two. But I couldn't get the Milanese loop on my hand comfortably, even the big one, right? So that's why I never went down that road. So I kind of wonder, like, how specifically close do you have to be for this silicone thing to fit? And then is it going to be like, remember the what was that Fleur Elastomer one on the first watch band? And I don't know about you, but whenever I did any sort of working out or playing music or whatever in a band, it would get really slippery and wet underneath and be gross, right? So I kind of wonder if that's going to be the same. I mean, I'd probably go for the braided loop one, the the sort of nylon-y looking one, right? But
breathability can be key. And if I was going to be working out, I have tended to use my Nike Fit knockoff from Amazon that has the holes in it. And that seems to solve the, I don't know what to call it. You know, if it was your butt crack, it'd be swamp butt. I don't know.
wrist slime.
Swamp wrist effect that the fluoroelastomer band can do. I've definitely had that. I've gotten sweaty with my watch.
Swamp wrist. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's good.
Well, it's cool. Yeah, yeah. I think the next cool feature was, and this would have really helped out with my grandson when Xavier, you know, number one fan of Spotcast. If he wanted to have an Apple Watch, but he couldn't because he had to have a phone to set the thing up, right? And now they have this family setup thing where one single phone can set up to five watches, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. So they end up being paired there. I think the one caveat is that those are for the LTE models, right? So it's like,
oh, are they?
You do the setup, but then they act as independent smart internet connected devices from there. See if the Wi-Fi only watches were capable of handling that.
Well, yeah, because they do sort of have the creepy, you know, parental, where is my kid and is he where I expect him to be right now kind of thing. I can think of other relationships where that might be something that would be not a good thing, but yeah, the fact that you can look on your phone and see that your kid is really sleeping over at Mary's house, you know, kind of thing. Hopefully he's not a boy, but you know what I mean? Like
just I just left the watch at Mary's house and went out to the club.
Or attached it to the dog at home or something.
Right? Why does he keep running around in circles? What's going on here?
Spends a lot of time in the backyard. What is he doing? And you can also limit their contacts. I mean, as a parent, I could see, you know, wanting to be a little helicoptery and, you know, maybe get the bubble wrap out and wrap my kid up. But, you know, like limit their contacts. That makes sense. You don't want them talking to strangers, which I do know some kids who have done that in the past, right? But yeah, it's just, I mean, I get the sort of parental angle to this feature, but I also find, you know, I think it can be used in sort of nefarious ways. You know what I'm saying? Like you know, the Police song, Every Breath You Take?
Yeah, it
has that dark side, you know?
Yeah, you wouldn't want somebody like, you know, unknowingly handing this to their spouse, right? Or not being forthcoming of like, oh, I got you this watch, check it out. And it's like, oh, I'm secretly tracking you because I don't trust you, right? Or I'm being very abusive and stalkery. Like, that's definitely a dark side that people need to be aware of. But I do think the other positive side of it that you brought is something that
Can we do a PSA?
Sure.
So there's a hand signal that if you're on a Zoom call or something like that, and the person who is in front of the camera is having trouble with somebody else in the room, there's a hand signal they can make to the people on the video to let them know that they're not okay. I don't know if you guys know about that.
No, this is the first I've heard of it.
Yeah, I can't remember what it is. You hold your hand up and I think you fold your thumb over or something like that. And that's to indicate to the people on the Zoom call that you're not okay. Just that's my PSA. I'll get some more information on it. But I don't know if we never talked about it on the show. And I know with everybody working from home and some people are going to be put in compromising positions that they normally would go to work to escape from kind of thing, right? So anyway, just...
Yeah, if people are having trouble understanding, although I don't know of what this particular thing is, so we can do some follow-up on that. I am aware that people who have been in abusive relationships have, you know, made phone calls to 911, but, you know, made the call as if they were calling for, like, a pizza. And the dispatcher is very confused, and then they slowly figure out, oh, I see what's going on. The abuser is, you know, close enough to overhear what you're saying, and so you have to be a little bit more sly, because they don't, you know, they limit your access to the phone sort of thing. So that makes sense. So that PSA. So that is, you know, that is a thing for folks to watch out for related to coming back to the watch of, like, you know, you've got to have, you know, fully informed consent for what you're doing here. And coming back to the happier side of this, I think the side that Apple probably is promoting more is the people who have dependents, you know, people dependent on, usually kids, but I want to talk about, you know, elderly parents, so people don't forget about that. You know, I've had coworkers that said, yeah, you know, I really would love to have an LTE watch for my children because they're kind of a little too young and we're not ready to give them a phone for just like all of the scary stuff that opens up of having to deal with as a parent, but also just the practical aspect of like, heaven help me if they like come home from school back when, you know, they went to school, And they're like, oh, I forgot this thing. Where's the phone? Oh, gosh, now we've lost this $100, $200, $300, $500 device. Where the heck is it? Hmm. Whereas a watch is like, all right, it's a little harder for them to get, and they sort of actively have to take it off, right? So it's something that's always with them, and they can always make an emergency call. You can make emergency calls to them. And I think a lot of those same sorts of concerns might also work for, you know, elderly parents who are like...
Exactly, and that's what I was going to go there, yeah.
They're not, you know, it's technical enough that maybe they might not even want a phone, but it's like, hey, can I convince you to wear this thing? And you can do phone calls and other things. We can stay in touch, and it's kind of not that big of a change to your life. I think this has a valuable use case for that.
Yeah, actually, a friend of the show, Peter Cook, has a son who's has CP, and so I think he talked about it on the show when we talked about it, but about the app, about the watch, or sorry, how the phone changed people's lives, and his son used to be able to wear his watch, like which he passed it down to him, and with his phone, and they were able to use the walkie-talkie feature that if he ever got to school and the elevators weren't working or whatever, he could call his dad from his watch and say, you know, hey, this is going wrong, and then Peter was able to talk to his son and talk to whoever was near, you know, his caretaker who would be at the school with him about the situation, which is another, you know, life-changing thing that the Apple Watch has done for people, as an example.
Yeah, this anyway. Goes a step in the right direction where people have wanted a fully disconnected watch. And this isn't quite that. You still have the, as I understand it, sort of mothership phone that these are connected to, but it's a good step that I think will cover a lot more use cases than what you would have had before.
Right. So I kind of miss, like I mentioned before, I was stuck in a meeting, so I kind of missed the Apple Watch SE. What's the deal with that?
That was the cheaper
that's
watch.
That's the low-end phone, the cheaper one. So they have two different versions. And they have the Series 6, and then they have the SE. It's just like with the phone, where they have the SE. The SE is just a more entry-level, lower price, without all the bells and whistles.
But is that, you still, like, you still compare it with your phone and kind of thing like that? Like, you can still do, like the OG watch was kind of sort of? Like?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't really say exactly what it was, but I imagine it's, you know, probably like a Series 4 type phone or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, roughly, maybe in a fancy new case or something. They didn't give the details. One thing that it seemed that was missing was the blood ox, because they said in particular that was only for the Series 6 watch. Mm-hmm. But presumably it does. Well, they didn't say whether it did ECGs or not. I don't know.
So I'm reading a CNET article that says SE does not have the FDA cleared ECG app.
It does not.
Still has some other fitness tracking capabilities and the fall detection feature in the Series 4. So yeah, I mean, just kind of as you expect, I think what I see in the SE is it's another opportunity to have a broader price model, right? It's everything you can do to have a, you know, blend of like, look, if you're listening to the show, you're probably not getting the SE, right? You're probably getting a more medium to premium model, because you're a fanatic, you're a fan. That's why you listen to this sort of content. But for people who are like, you know, that's a big chunk of change, but at $279, and it's not, you know, maybe not the like all the bells and whistles, but it's not an older watch, you know, or a refurb watch. Yeah, I might buy one of those to try things out.
Well, I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago that the most popular phone that Apple sells, or I think the most popular phone, is the 10R. Which one is the one that's like sort of 10R?
Yeah, it's 10R. I don't know if that's still true, but
no, I think it's true. This is a number that we talked about a couple of weeks ago.
I know, that might be cumulative over time. But is it currently the one that's selling the most? Probably not, because that one's pretty old.
I don't know, but if you think about it, it's more approachable to the general public who aren't the big fanboys, right? And it like yeah, so here it's saying here in this article I'm looking at that, you know, the 6 has the S6 chip, whereas the SE has the S5, which is, you know, last year's model chip, I guess. But it's twice as fast as a Series 3, so it's still an upgrade from buying an older watch, like you said, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Yeah, it doesn't have the oxygen sensor, obviously. Yeah, I mean, like I was just saying, like from the point of view of like the reason why the 10R sells well is because it's not, you know, the $1,000 phone complaining about, right? So
price is more approachable. The most important factor for a lot of people.
Yeah. They do have new watch faces. I'll just mention it as a checking the box. I wasn't particularly particularly excited about them because I'm like, well, it'd be kind of nice if we had third-party watch faces, but I do appreciate that they had some that I could see being useful, like the time zone watch, right? So if you're working with people in different time zones, it'd be kind of nice to see, like, what time is it over there?
My note on the watch faces is I wrote watch faces.
they continue to have various designs come out. Some, I think, you know, personally, because I think these are all very personal, some work better than others, but, you know, it's not as great, I think, as having third-party watch faces be available and just let the market decide what's out there. You know, if people want a really ugly watch face, I guess that's the really ugly watch face. I just don't want to be, you know, limited necessarily to the watch faces that we have, especially.
Yeah, there are quite a number of faces for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the early concerns that I'd had before, and I think I was a very staunch defender of, like, well, I'd rather not have third-party watch faces until the battery life gets, you know, kind of good enough. And I think if Apple's like, oh, you know, battery life's gotten good enough that we can brighten up the always on display, I'm like, all right, now's the time. Now's the time. You've got enough headroom, I think, to allow third-party watch faces to happen so that in the worst possible case, there is a very poorly developed third-party watch face that's sapping people's battery life. It won't be quite as dramatic of a problem, I think, in this modern era.
So I was watching a video on YouTube or TV the other day about how, you know, COVID is affecting people's industries because they all have to work from home. And there was a fitness trainer talking about how he's now able to use online classes. Like, he can do like Zoom calls and do workouts with people on Zoom. I think it was on it was actually a news report on one of the American stations. And he was talking about how he now can do these one-on-one classes with people, or one-to-many kind of things, rather than having them all into, you know, all sweating away in the same studio, which leads us to how Apple is now going to take that away from him too.
I mean, maybe, right? So Fitness Plus, this is the one in the recap that I understood maybe one of the least. I was like, all right, so...
Oh, really?
So you get access for paying your subscription price, you get access to workouts. And as far as I understand, they are not like live workouts. They're video recorded, pre-recorded workouts. Right. So the kind of content I could get for free on YouTube, that pays, you know, pays the way. And I guess it does have the syncing of your information from, you know, the watch and health apps stuff that can show up, you know, there right there on the screen to motivate you to, like, hey, let me get my heart rate up to what I was looking to get. Okay, that's cool. I mean, I guess it could just look at my watch now and see that, but that might be annoying to do. And it could also show up on like your Apple TV too, I think, right? You're doing this.
I got to imagine that over time it'll be more interactive because you do have two sensors available to at least two, but in general, people are going to have two sensors available to them. They've got one on the wrist and they've got a phone, which they could put into a strap on your leg or something like that.
Or in your pocket.
In your pocket. And then you have a very Wii Fit-like experience. Now, the videos have to be made so that the interactive nature works, but I have to imagine that's coming because that seems like the killer app for this thing, where you actually see you see yourself or an icon of an avatar of yourself doing activity on the screen. Yeah. Yeah, on your Apple TV.
They showed that in the WWC, they showed like the fact that, you know, your watch could sort of keep track or anticipate what kind of movements you're making, like for the fitness stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, and it also was interesting, there was like a four-word mantra that they were all saying the same. It reminds me of a famous politician, I can't remember who it was, a couple of weeks ago, was going on about how you can always remember these four words. But in this case, it was workout, trainer, time, music, right? Which means, you know, you choose a workout of a certain type, pick your trainer, tell them how long you want to do this for, and then Apple Music kicks in and gives you the inspiring music to go along with your workout, right? Mm-hmm. $9.99 US a year, I guess, and $9.99 a month, and $79 a year if that's what you're looking for.
Now, that seems kind of high to me, but some people might want to pay that. But, you know, if it were bundled into some kind of a package...
Well, then... that would be good. Yeah, I wonder if they could bundle something like that. Yeah. What do you think, Jaime? Yeah.
If only there was one bundle to rule them
one
all.
One bundle?
To rule them all.
Yeah.
And that's a good or very poor segue to roll into Apple One. There are at least three of them bundles. So I don't know why they called it Apple One. It seems like it's Apple Mini.
It's six or five. I don't know.
Apple Myriad, you know. But this is something that has been rumored and gotten stronger for a while. Let's see if I can do this rundown correctly. I took notes on this part, but I don't know if they're good. So you have an individual bundle at $14.95 per month US, which includes Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, Apple Arcade, and 50, that's 50 gigabytes of iCloud storage.
Right.
Then my next note says the family plan for $19.95 per month has everything that that one had, right? Music, TV Plus, arcade, but bumps up the iCloud storage to 200 gigabytes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the, I was thinking about this morning.
Premiere.
I say Premiere because I'm in the United States. I am aware because I watch enough soccer, football, for those of you in Europe. It's like Premiere, as in you are happy and you're happier, sort of pronunciation. Premiere for $29.95 a month, which includes music, TV Plus, arcade, a very lofty 2 terabytes of iCloud storage, and then throws in News Plus and Fitness Plus as part of that package.
Right. Yeah. So for me, I mean, like the part you haven't talked about is they're going to help people like me who have 2 Apple IDs merging together, right?
Oh, I wasn't in the recap that I saw, but like...
No, they're true? Not. I'm being facetious. Oh, okay. They are not. I still have the same... And so now I'm thinking, okay, how do I move away from my .Mac one, move all that content in iCloud over to my Apple ID that I use for all my purchases, right? Because some guy at Apple told me years and years ago that's how I should do it. Anyway, so I'm naturally going to fall into the family one because Carol and I are already on the 2 gigabyte, 2 terabyte, 200 gigabyte plan as a family, right, for iCloud. We have a single plan for music. My TV Plus account is going to expire any day now because of the phone I got last year, right? So for me, it's naturally going into the family one for me is going to be a no-brainer, but I don't know what I'm going to do with the arcade because there are no games for my 5-year-old granddaughter to play. But anyway, so for me, I think that's the one. I don't know about... I really don't care that much about news and I don't know. Fitness is an edge case for me, but Carol might be interested in that. So yeah, so for me, I think family makes sense. You know, what about you guys?
Yeah, so I'm already paying $9.99 a month for music and $1 a month for the iCloud stuff. So that's $11. So for another $4, I can get TV Plus and arcade. Yeah, it's probably pretty reasonable. Why not? I would like to get the news, but I don't want to spend another...
Well, you get the news now. This is News Plus.
News Plus, I wouldn't mind getting that, but I'm not going to spend another $15 for that. And fitness.
I see. As an individual, it's not a fair deal going from 14 to 29 bucks or 15 to 29 bucks.
Right. But yeah, so the individual, though, makes sense for me.
One of our former co-hosts has uses the 2 terabyte plan with iCloud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might be one of the things that people will have to consider, right? For me, and Mark, you don't have Apple TV Plus right now, do you?
I don't, no.
Okay, so...
You're not missing much.
But that might change the equation, right? Because I was looking at this and like, all right, very similar to Mark. I'm like, I'm paying for music. I'm paying for the 50 gigs iCloud storage. That's total $11 a month. So for $4 more, what would I get? And I said, well, for $4 more, I get what is on paper $10. So that's $5 for TV Plus and $5 for arcade of value. But then I went deeper than the on paper and I said, all right, well, I have been getting the free subscription for Apple TV Plus that I had with my device. And I've largely started to run out of stuff to watch. Like I could start watching next level of things, but there just isn't enough for my use case. Your mileage may vary enough for me to say, yeah, I would continue to pay specifically for something to get Apple TV Plus and then, you know, pay for Apple TV Plus and then have this other thing for free, which would be arcade. Right. And I said, well, you know, there's good stuff, but I would probably have to wait until there was a backlog of things that I could go or that they brought in some other provider of content that was included as part of TV Plus, right? So that was one thing that I was considering. And I said, okay, well, let me look at the other way. Would I end up paying for Apple Arcade and then effectively getting Apple TV Plus for free? And I said, no, I don't think there's enough for me personally on Arcade. And that's not a knock against it per se, just I don't have that use case, right? Like I think Arcade looks like it works pretty well if you're looking to get like, you know, your family off of in-app purchase, you know, Farmville laden type stuff. I think that would be pretty valuable. But again, I don't have kids. And so I'm like, well, what am I going to do with this? Am I going to get enough value? And I was like, it's borderline. Like I could see a case where I can argue myself into the extra $4 a month. Cause then it's like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. Just right now, as we're sitting here on, middle of September 2020, I'm like, not enough, but maybe something might change in the future to change that equation. It's very close. So it's a very close no, but I did really think about about it a lot.
What if, do you fall into the family plan?
$14. I'm just curious how the math works.
Yeah, like if it was a dollar more, like I think very clearly to me of like if it was a dollar more, I'm like, oh yeah, absolutely, I would do that. Yeah. If it's $2 more, you know, four, maybe, and possibly I'm getting a little bit influenced because I have started to watch the Ted Lasso. This is like a shadow pick, I guess, the Ted Lasso series, mm-hmm. and it's I would say that my review of it so far, about halfway through the series, is that it's not an outstanding one. I'm not saying like stop what you're doing, go watch this. This isn't like an event type series, but for me, it's just so dang wholesome, and I'm like, yeah, I can kind of see why people like this. This is a really good sort of warm, fuzzy feeling thing where the main character, Ted Lasso, is very nice and wholesome, despite the fact that so many people around him are so terrible to him. And he's not stupid. He's not dopey. He's just a very pure person. And in these times, it does feel a little good to watch that. So I might be convinced at $4 sort of difference versus the, or I guess closer to $3 than it is the, you know, closer to, you know, $4 to $5 difference that it is now.
So wait, you're not going to go with Apple One?
No, I think I was very tempted, and then I sat down.
But even as a family, you're not going to go?
No, my significant like other is less impressed with Apple TV Plus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she's less impressed. So I'm like, all right, so I can't even argue for it, you know, on her behalf sort of thing. Of like, oh, she's getting the value. It would be more selfishly for me, and I couldn't argue for it even from that route. But it's close. I'm not knocking it as like, this is not a good value for you, the listener out there. I think that's why I'd asked you, Mark, you know, have you watched any of the Apple TV Plus? Because for you, it's like, oh, like you have a whole bunch of stuff to watch because you haven't been watching it for the past year, right? Whereas for me, I'm like, oh, like I'll get a new movie this month, next month, maybe a new movie. I'm like, all right, that's not enough for me to pay, right? But for you, it's like, oh, I got a new movie and I have these backlog of movies to watch.
Yeah, it's not clear that I would actually watch it, but the option is there. It doesn't seem like I have all that much time to watch TV these days, but maybe I would if there was. I'd find time if there was better stuff on. It's true, and I do already. You know, I spend whatever. I mean, I've even lost track of what I spend on Netflix because they keep raising the price. So I have Netflix. I have Amazon Prime. So there's lots of stuff there that I pay for.
I think when I thought about it, I was like, you know, the amount of time I spent on this at my hourly rate, I've actually lost money by not just subscribing to the damn thing, or just letting a coin make the decision. Because honestly, I said what, from $11 to $15, and I'm like, oh, I probably should have just done it. But
yeah, it's only $4 a month. That's only $50 a year. You spend more than that on coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
mm-hmm. A lot more than that on coffee, I'm sure. I certainly do.
So 10 years ago, I mean, I can't remember when I registered as an Apple developer, but sometime in like the tens, right? I know I downloaded iPhone SDK in 2008 when it first came out, but it wasn't until 2010 when the iPad was released that I became a full-time developer, which leads us to our next piece. Right, Jaime? 10th anniversary of the iPad.
It is, in fact, yes, right. The 10th anniversary of the iPad, and good timing for the 8th gen iPad to be out. And if you're doing the math thinking, wait a minute, they skipped some years. The whole lineage of the iPads gets a little complicated because they do have a few various options. Seemed like a nice update, and we'll end up talking about another iPad, the iPad Air, in here as well. For folks that I've seen online, they were like, oh, the iPad lineup's so confusing. I'm like, no, it's only confusing if you have a lot of money and you have enough money that you could buy any of them that you wanted, but not so much money that you don't just like immediately, of course, I'm going to get the highest end model no matter what, right? I think going along with the same lines for the phones and the watches, the answer to the question is, which one should I get is, how much money do you have? That's the one that's for you. And you can decide if you want to spend a little less, you can decide if you want to stretch and spend a little bit more. They've got a price range that follows of like, I have $300 to I have darn near $2,000, I think, for the highest spec one. And each $100 increment roughly in between is covered by one or more of the models. Mm-hmm. You know, so iPad 8th gen, you know, it's got a pretty good price. It's got an even lower price for the education market. And they also came out with the iPad Air, which I wrote in my notes, has a Touch ID in the top button, the sleep wake button.
The power button, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Interesting.
Yeah, I noticed that it had a narrower bezel, which is why I was kind of wondering if they were going to go Face ID, but they went with the Touch ID. Touch ID, right?
So it makes me wonder now, just occurred to me, that a button Touch ID for the iPhone in this COVID day would be a very useful thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I was waiting for Mask ID to come out.
Like, if
I wonder with the iPhone 12, we'll see that. I mean, I wonder, too late for that, but...
Yeah, unless they really timed it out very fortuitously. I don't expect it on this year's model. But it does
raise the question. But who knows? They were planning this for a long time for the iPad, and they must have been planning this before COVID for the iPad.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So maybe they were also planning it for the iPhone. We just haven't seen it yet.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be interesting to see, because it's something I was thinking about when they announced it. And I said, oh, wow. Okay. So if you had a device that had both Face ID and Touch ID, how might you end up using that? So I would guess that the security behind both will differ. And I would guess that they wouldn't be exactly equivalent.
Two-factor authentication all in one phone.
Yeah. It's like, well, okay. So Face ID thinks it could possibly be you, but the bottom half doesn't match the model. Cool. Well, can we get the second factor here of, well, tell me about the fingerprint, right? How does that look? Oh, that appears to match. Good. Then we've got enough to verify that this user is who they say they are.
Speaking of somebody who lives in a northern climate and we end up getting cold a lot and we wear gloves, mm-hmm. Face ID was a godsend to Canadians in terms of being able to open our phones. Yeah. But again, if you had the scarf up over your nose, you couldn't be recognized. So having to take your gloves off or buy gloves that have the goofy little finger thing that never seems to last forever. Touch ID would be cool, like, you know, to have in the case of in the mask wearing time that we're here in. But so are you thinking they would have both options?
Yeah, like, and I was wondering how those would, like, one way of looking is like, oh, it's an alternative. If you prefer Touch ID, use Touch ID. If you prefer Face ID, use Face ID. But you could do more interesting things and say, all right, well, what if we can use them in tandem? So, right, you know, if I'm sitting on my couch, I can just use Face ID because that's way easier, right? Just lift up the phone.
Can't use voice print ID.
Voice print, yeah. As you guys in Canada are mumbling, like,
my bank authenticates me with my voice.
Yeah, yeah. Which I can already hear the Canadians in the background saying, but what happens when it's cold outside and I've got 10 layers over my face and now I'm mumbling like Kenny McCormick from South Park? Right? Like, you know, there's always ways.
You got to do your Bane impression again.
Yeah, yeah. And you're always finding ways to deal. And I get that. But I'm wondering, like, okay, let's just pretend for the sake of argument that Touch ID is that style of Touch ID, to be very clear, is like the little skinny strip that they had that fits on the button.
Next gen Touch ID, they call it.
Yeah. Let's pretend that on an apples to apples basis, when you compare the security for that versus the security of Face ID, let's pretend that the new touch strip style Touch ID is just, you know, a little bit less secure than Face ID. So now if a user has both Face ID and the touch strip ID set up, hypothetically, if I was an attacker, I'd say, okay, I'm going to attack the weaker one, right? So that's where I think you might have the, you know, sort of ultra security mode of like, I am using, you know, unencumbered, unblocked face to open this phone. And I'm also putting my finger on the touch strip to say like, oh, there are two different mechanisms that claim that this is the user. So we have a higher level of authenticity for this user. And that can also be useful for areas where you aren't quite sure from either sensor. Because it's like, okay, well, this user is wearing a mask and they could detect that you're wearing a mask or you've obscured the lower half of your face in some way, which could be an attack vector. Just saying, like, for people who want like a COVID-friendly Face ID. The downside is you've made it easier for people to attack, right? Because they have to get less of your face correct. So if I was Apple's engineer thinking, how do I deal with that situation where I normally want Face ID to be very secure? I have a situation where we would allow just a little bit less security, but not really a whole lot less security, because we can say, well, because you're wearing a mask, now you got to get that second factor, as Mark put it, of use the Touch ID to give us a better picture of who you are, right? Because now it's like, all right, so as an attacker, I'd have to get at least half of your face correct, and I would have to do something that can fool the Touch ID sensor. Does that make sense of like how these things might work together and aren't necessarily a replacement for one or the other?
You may be overthinking it a little bit.
I really overcomplicated it because I got all excited when I saw, oh, that's something that could fit on a phone. What would you do?
Yeah. My guess would be that the cheaper phones would have the touch in the button, and yet they could, so they could still give you the full screen experience, but in a lower end phone, because they don't have to have the high end camera. They can put the touch sensor in the button.
Well, they get rid of the chin and they get rid of the notch, right? In those cases too, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, it's possible that it is also available in the high end phone, because why not, right? But my guess is it would probably be an either or. You could choose which one you wanted to use, I'm thinking. But it might be available to devs to use for both. It's quite possible.
Well, there's the biometric identifier thing that tells whether or not you're using Touch ID or Face ID in the local authentication framework.
Right. And that's that's hard coded for your phone, basically.
That's
not an option.
Yeah. So let's talk about this A14 Bionic processor chip thing here, because we touched on this at the beginning of the show. They said 5 nanometer transistors. They said it's measured in atoms. Did you catch that, Mark?
Yeah. So this is nothing new.
Except the fact that you've been telling us that there's only so small you can go before things start falling apart.
So a hydrogen atom, which is the smallest kind of atom, is about an angstrom in radius or diameter.
Isn't that where angstrom comes from?
Well, the guy's name.
No, I mean, but if a hydrogen atom is the smallest possible, it's like what, just one electron and one
proton and one electron. Proton. Yeah. But the size of it, it's not precisely one angstrom, because you can't really define what the size of it is, but it's roughly.
If you had Heisenberg compensators, you could, but never mind.
So a nanometer is 10 angstroms. So if you have 5 nanometer technology, that's, what did I say? An angstrom,
five angstroms left to go. Is that what I did my math right?
A nanometer is 10 angstroms. So 5 nanometer is 50 angstroms. So that's about roughly 50 hydrogen atoms. Now, a silicon atom is much bigger than a hydrogen atom, probably like 20 times bigger, roughly, is my guess. So 50, maybe not 20 times bigger, but it's bigger, So we're talking, when you're talking about 50 nanometers, you're talking like 5 or 10 atoms, wide. That's pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, as I mentioned earlier, that's not really true, because it's an effective size. It's an electrical size, not a physical size. And so electric fields, when you put a voltage on these things, it creates an electric field, which causes something called depletion, which makes the electrical carriers get confined in a smaller space. And there's quantum effects that does the same thing, or similar thing. It's in effect as if it were that wide. It's not physically that wide. But still, there's not much more room left to go. Yeah, there's really not.
I'm looking at my handy-dandy periodic table right now.
Yep.
What's the symbol for silicon?
SI.
Oh, here it is over here. 14, it says.
Yeah, so that's the atomic weight. Or, sorry, the atomic number. That's the number of protons.
Yeah, so it's 10 versus, or 14 versus 1.
Right.
Yeah,
but that's not the size. That's just the number.
No, yeah, because you have the first orbit, which is 2 electrons, and then you have 8 on the next one, right?
Yep. And it goes as roughly as R squared. So you're probably talking, you're probably in the third shell.
Yeah.
That would be 9 times 1 angstrom. So 10 angstroms. Yeah, 10 angstroms. Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Good guess. Okay. Yep. Just checking your math.
Yep.
And your physics.
It's been a while. but I still remember some of this stuff.
Yep. Yeah, and of course the A14 Bionic also has, 16 cores for faster machine learning. And they have some CPU machine learning accelerators in there. I think 11.8 billion transistors is what I wrote down.
Yep.
Pretty quick.
Couple of transistors. Yeah.
Just a few.
Luckily, they don't charge by the transistor.
That's true. Or maybe they do. You don't know.
Yeah.
And a better camera, I think, a 12-megapixel camera. Do we have 12-megapixel cameras on our phones currently? We must.
Yeah, they're not coming in iPad.
And 4K video.
Than the iPhone.
10.9-inch liquid display. So this one is $599, the iPad Air. And it works with the Magic Keyboard, right? As well as the, what's the other one called? I forget what the other one's called. But the iPad we were talking about earlier, the 8th gen is, where was it? Yeah, $329 for the smaller iPad. iPad, or to the bottom line iPad, right? They still have 4 or 5 iPads to choose from, right? Because they still have the Mini in there, and they still have the 2 Pros. And $299 for education, I wrote down as well. So, interesting. And they have a new combo keyboard thing. That I don't know if it's new, but they have a different keyboard for this guy, for the cheaper Air. So that's where we are. Is there anything else we want to talk about with this? Oh, yeah, the commercial. It already does that. Let me.
Yeah, they had released this commercial of the introducing Apple Watch Series 6. It already does that, which does the, you know, and the conceit is imagine a future where, and it's like, oh, actually the watch already does that. Oh, okay, well, imagine a future where this other thing, oh, it already does that, right? Like it knows your altitude. It knows your blood oxygen.
Your heart rate, yeah.
Yeah, it does, you know, all of these things. I don't know how effective these are. I thought it was a different approach, a pretty good way to explain, you know, here we are in the Series 6. What is it that this does? And if you haven't been following along, which, you know, there's only so many people who could possibly listen to the show, and not everybody does, this might be something useful for folks who are sort of more casual and wondering what's going on out there. And the one thing I will say is I get impressed by weirdo things, so I apologize. I was very impressed when they showed the young girl playing tennis with her watch. I was like, oh, she actually knows what she's doing. And I don't recognize her. I apologize if I should recognize her from the tour or something. But she actually knows how to play tennis. I could tell by the grip. I could tell by the way she's striking the ball. Usually when I see actors in these sorts of things, like, you know, they'd never have somebody, you know, throwing a football who didn't know how to throw a football. But they have plenty of people.
She's probably like one of the top tennis players in the world, and here's Jaime critiquing her.
No, I looked and I was like, oh wow, she's using
the mountain climber knew how to climb a mountain too, right?
I was like, oh, she's using a Western grip and possibly an extreme Western grip. She's not using something that would be way harder than just code here. And
time out.
I was looking at where is she hitting. I was like, all right, mostly from the baseline, a little bit in, but like that's what they do because, you know, that's how they get the better looking shots. But I was like, wow, she actually knows how to play, which is not typical for representations of tennis in the media.
Oh, the horror. I'm just remembering in high school, one of my best friends was a really good tennis player, and he used to make us play tennis with him, and he used to kill us. The horror. Anyway.
Yeah, just to translate for the Canadians out there, imagine if you were accustomed to seeing hockey.
Wait, we don't have tennis up here in Canada?
No, well, I mean no, because it snows, right? There's no snow courts. That's only in video games.
imagine. So when Jaime says tennis, think curling.
Yeah, imagine for your national pastime. Imagine that you saw most media representations.
You know, lacrosse is our official sport, right? You know that, right?
Oh, is that right? See, well, that's how little I know because I'm on the American side, right?
Is it more than hockey? Is lacrosse?
Actually our national sport is lacrosse, in spite of the fact that we all love hockey. Yeah,
huh. Right. So for hockey, imagine if most media representations showed people holding the hockey stick upside down. That's usually the rough equivalent of what I see in tennis representations in media, which is why I got weirdly geeked out in this.
I gotta find out who this girl in the commercial is.
She looks a little young to be on the WTA, or at least higher ranking in WTA. Yeah. So, you know, because there's it's a power game, right? Like Serena Williams, the greatest of all time, completely changed the women's game. So I don't think this girl is as good as her skills look. I don't think she's quite, you know, large enough to generate power to be like top 10 in the world for the professionals, but maybe for the juniors, right? Because she looks like she knows what she's doing.
Oh yeah, her. I see. I got a picture of her lined up on my YouTube right now. Interesting. All right. Well, we'll have to follow up on who that is next week, I guess. So, in the words of Gomer Pyle, surprise, 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 they introduced what else today? Like, actually rolled out today.
Yeah. So today, as we're recording, it is September 16th. This is one day after the September 15th event. And Apple said, oh yeah, we're releasing tomorrow, which is today, which is the 16th. Yeah, like, yeah, iOS 14 and everything else is released. And it was crazy for folks because we have this article here that describes it like Apple developers are scrambling over the accelerated iOS 14 release. So unlike usual sort of setup, you know, you would have
more clickbait.
The event and then roughly about a week of time with the GM, the Gold Master release of, you know, latest versions of Xcode and et cetera for folks to CPO to, you know, actually physically submit apps, but also, you know, make sure that there wasn't any final change, you know, post beta that might have broken your app. None of that applied. Like, if you wanted to be there on day one, and while you're listening to this podcast, kind of interested to hear, hit us up, hashtag AskMTGC, or come check out our Slack channel. Kind of very curious how people dealt with the mad dash to go update, check out your apps, see if anything's broken, and if it is, fix it, and then submit your patched versions to be
there. Wait, you don't think people have tried their apps already on the betas?
Yeah, but like, you know, how many times have we seen even the production release of iOS do something horribly wrong? Remember iOS 8 that they couldn't make phone calls for one model?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, fundamental thing. Like, they messed it up before.
Minor detail.
You know, I would be sweating if I was like, oh my God, we want to be there on day one. You know, what are we going to do? And then looking at it from the user standpoint, it's like, well, if I'm a user, oh, iOS 14 is available. Hey, where are all those apps with app clips? It's like, good question. Mm. Where are all those apps with app clips and all these wonderful things that are new to iOS 14?
Right. Interesting. Well, I just looked at the wise words of James Thompson, who posted this morning. Developers, you don't need to be ready for day one. Just take your time and get it right. It's 2020. Cut yourself some slack. Prioritize your mental health. This is also developers. Boom. Day one, losers. Because his apps are out already. But
yeah, that was weird. I don't understand why they ended up doing it that way. Like, no, granted, you know, the watches being available on Friday the 18th means, okay, well, you've got a line in the sand of when the production version of iOS needs to be there. I kind of wonder why they either didn't, you know, delay the watch's availability to 1 week later, which is kind of more in line with when they generally release, or why not make the tough line in the sand and say, this is where we're going to draw the line for iOS 14 and have the gold.
Well, I think they released something today, right? They released, I think, or yesterday. Didn't the iPad was available right away? The new iPad?
Was it available in stores?
Yeah, yeah. That's why the OSs had to all come out today, because they released hardware.
Yeah, it's really weird. I don't know whether to blame marketing or blame software engineering or possibly both in this thing, but it ended up and not just our opinions, but it sounds like a lot of opinions out there in the World Wide Web is like, yeah, this was not the ideal way to do it for developers or users.
Yeah, definitely. I just followed up the 8th generation iPad with the A12 we just talked about, the one for $329. It ships today. Like, you can buy it today. The iPad Air is coming in October, it says. So yeah, so they did ship the new iPad, which and all of the new devices we talked about today are coming with either Watch OS 7 or iOS 14, iPad OS 14, and I believe the Mac is out today too, right? Yesterday it was just a beta that was out. You guys have a look?
Big Sur, let me see. I have a little red indicator on my software update. What is this telling me? And let me try not to exit. Oh, only Safari is available right now. Safari 14. So I'm going to carefully back out of here. So
yeah, because the GM for Xcode. Oh yeah, the GM for Xcode 12 came out yesterday, as well as some iPad, like I said, iPad OS, but not the Mac one. I think we're still.
It's less than ideal.
I'm only seeing Catalina still. I'm not seeing Mac OS 11 yet. Oh, Safari 14 isn't there.
10.6, 10.16, isn't it?
And 15.6 is the latest one for me.
Yeah, I was being facetious about 10.16 versus Mac 11.
Right.
Yeah, so yeah, Big Sur 11 is still beta 6, it says. And then the application side, we have Xcode. Oh, I've already downloaded it, that's why. All right. Lots of fun. I mean, not the world's greatest event, but then I don't think we were expecting after, you know, our predictions the last couple of weeks. But yeah, it's interesting that all of a sudden you have to get the emails saying, get your apps ready. Yeah. Usually there's like a bit of window, right? Isn't there like normally like a week of heads up?
That's the whole point of the scramble is that, there is a week or so to get everything ready. But this time it was just one day.
Yeah, that final readiness, right? Yeah. Where, you know, to your point, Tim, normally you should be testing very early on from WWDC of like, in general, does our app even seem to work and start dealing with it? And it can be tough in the short 3 months to get there. But there is always that last, okay, let's make really sure that the final version that is actually going to go on devices works. And that something, again, as silly as phone calls don't work, didn't accidentally slip in there because, you know, bugs happen. And it is odd. I kind of wondered, like, did they have app review all juiced up on Red Bull rules, and everybody, all hands on deck, no PTO, everybody get ready to review the massive glut of submissions. You know, did folks submit and get through the store in a store review in a very sort of timely fashion? I kind of wonder how it went. I'd be interested in hearing some of those stories. I'm just glad I didn't have anything that I was shipping that needed to be in there. So you have my sympathies.
I guess we're at the pick portion of our show. Jaime, do you have a pick?
I do. And it is the very unironically selected new iOS 14 widgets you can try today article from TechCrunch. Mm-hmm. So longtime fans of the show will know that I do not upgrade to iOS versions on the first day, and generally not even in the first week. So I am very carefully watching the interwebs for all of you bleeding edge guinea pig folks. If you are interested, or a week or two from now, I'll probably mention on the show, there are things like the Aviary Twitter client has widgets that let you see tweets, or you've got Soar, which apparently is a premium music player app that has widgets that look really neat and help you get your music playing experience. There are other ones like Dice from PCalc, those fine folks, that has a physics-based simulation of polyhedral dice for use in tabletop role-playing games such as Dungeons and Dragons. That seems kind of nice to see that. That'd be nifty for game times, and many, many more. So while I did say I kind of wonder what's going to happen to all those delicious app clips and widgets and etc., it looks like folks are starting to put things out, and this is one of those lists of iOS 14 widgets you can try, as it says today, which is on the 16th. So hopefully,
how was it physics based?
Sorry,
does anybody know? How is Dice physics based? Is it actually?
Because he's got some.
Oh, it's actually showing the dice rolling around. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. I'm beta tester on his app. Yeah.
Yeah, I assumed it wasn't just run the simulation
and pick a random number. Yeah.
That it was like, hey, what if we could show you the thing is going on there? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I wonder if it actually rolls and ends up on the number that, like, if he's using physics to roll the dice, and then the number that comes on the top is the top face.
Whichever direction he's decided is orientation up from the plane or from the camera.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it's doing. It's got to be right.
Yeah, and that's if for folks who don't get that, if you haven't played tabletop games that use those, I would say go check out a board game shop in your local area where it, and if appropriate given the conditions, and take a look, and you'll see not only the polyhedral dice, like the 20-sided dice that is common for Dungeons and Dragons, but if you see people playing, you'll notice that it's not just enough to have that there. People have decided to add some fun theme to the randomness, so you'll see people who have a what's essentially like a tube, but it is a sculpted like tower from a castle, like turret, right, that has steps on it, and you have like a dragon at the top or something, or possibly at the bottom, and you drop the dice on there, and it bounces to the bottom, and then whatever it is at the bottom of the moat or lake sort of thing, that's what your number is, right? People add that to add something extra, some enthusiasm there. So I think that's why, although I don't know, I assume that dice here from PCalc, I assume that's why they went that route instead of the, just give you a random number and call it good. It's like, we can do a little bit more to give you some of that flavor in a digital form of what the physical dice would be doing.
Yeah. By the way, a couple comments about the Apple event that I wanted to mention too. One is that, do you guys notice it was almost exactly 1 hour long?
Yeah.
And I guess now that they can actually produce them, they can predict the time. Because they used to also run however long it took, right? 90 minutes often, right? And also the little Easter eggs they had in there where they were zooming through Apple Park, going from one section to another to talk to the people. And a couple of times they came across Craig Federighi, and he kind of like just shook his head and said no, which I think was sort of like, there's no phone, sort of in my mind anyway.
Yeah, maybe.
That is one of the things that they can do to add a little bit of fun. I would have liked to see Johnny Ive walking through in the background with like a coffee cup that he's sipping from or something. Like, oh, what's he doing?
In a robe with his slippers on.
Yeah, like he's just chilling, right? And just have some fun with it. They can do that sort of thing that you couldn't normally do with a live event.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. No Phil Schiller either. That's another interesting one. Okay. So, my pick, actually, I have a question before we get to that. I'm just looking at the Apple stock price currently. What was the price of the, of course it went down after yesterday, surprise surprise, which it always does, right? What was the price when it split, after it split?
Do you remember, after it split, it shot up to, I think, like 135, something like that.
No, but what was it when it actually split, though?
At the time of the split, it was around 125, maybe.
Okay, because it's just a little at 112 right now, so.
I told you.
It went down today. Well, yeah, but it went down today.
Or, yeah, but split.
The whole week.
Yeah, I mean, I've been telling everyone, people don't want to listen, but splits don't really mean anything for the stock price. It's a little, there's some psychology.
No, I was curious.
Yeah.
I was just curious because I was kind of, I was able to keep track of it. It's like switching from metric to or some Fahrenheit to metric. It's, you know, your scale gets changed, right? In the middle of the game. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, because I remember it was like 90 something last time it split. But anyway. So my pick is a pretty simple one. It's just sort of something I've been doing this week. A couple of things I've been doing this week, but one of them is Muhammad Azam had come out with a core data in Swift UI tutorial. So far he's done 3, and I think he's planning on 4 videos, where he kind of goes through the new template for core data and in Swift UI, and takes it a bit further, goes through, adds some sort of model view kind of stuff into the mix, sort of gives a big, good explanation. It's got a couple of nice little tricks for working with Swift UI, using like creating an extension for your navigation stack, which basically means it becomes reusable throughout the whole app. Sort of some smart thinking around the way the code works. But yeah, so if you're curious about working with core data in Swift UI using the new persistence container kind of metaphor, I'd recommend this set of videos, and they're for free up on the YouTube under his channel, and I'll have a link to the show notes on that. But he's also got a Udemy course. I don't know how you say it, like potato potato. But they, or Premier. They've got he's got a course there on Swift UI generally that seems to be doing quite well with. So yeah, check that out as well. And that's it for me. All right, well, I guess that's it for another week. So hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, how would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
All right, Mark, if people want to get in touch with you,
Mark at smapsoft.com.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, I think I was saying last time. I'm getting a lot of spam these days.
Yeah.
What are we
going to
do?
It's the nature of the business. All right, my name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machine is where you'll probably find me. So until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. This is friend of the show, Mike Van Ockmans. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Please leave a comment on the website, and if you can, please write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
So last week, my experiment with you know, trying to figure out what's going on here with you know, what I'm dealing with, like in terms of static and stuff, didn't work. And so now I'm like, it's a native Mac, naked Mac. I've just got a grounded power supply plugged in, and I've got the microphone going right into the USB on the back. No monitors. No other third-party stuff, you know. I think the monitor, my old monitor, might be what's causing the ground hum. But it's interesting because Xavier was over on the weekend editing Spotcasts, and I sort of said, "Well, could you hear the static on my track?" He goes, "Yeah, I could hear that." And so I was showing him how to do the filters and stuff like that. He says, "But there's this high-pitched whine on the track," and I'm like, "What high-pitched whine?" And he says, "You know, there's a high-pitched whine in the track." And so they said, "First of all, I have tinnitus, right? Mm. So if there's like a certain frequency of high-pitchedness, I can't hear it."
Yeah.
So who knows how many years we've been serving up, you know, high-pitched wines to people in our podcast. Yeah.
So the good news is probably most people's equipment isn't good enough to reproduce that high pitched whine.
Yeah. So I basically, with his, 17-year-old ears, I showed him how what we do with EQ, where we pinpoint a frequency and we drag it right down to like nothing. So it looks, if you look at it, it looks like almost like a black hole in the middle of the bar that goes across. Mm-hmm. And I sort of said, well, so I dragged down a part and I said, is it here? And then moved it a little to the left, a little to the right. And he says it got taken out. So we'll have to have some discerning ears listen to Spotcast to see if they can see the, because he said it was also on Jonathan's track too, which is kind of interesting. So,
And I thought the high-pitched whine was just you guys talking about how bad that last Star Trek series was.
Yeah, well, there's another season coming, Mark. You got that to look forward to.
I gave up my subscription.
Really?
Yeah, oh. I just got the free one and I never paid for it. It wasn't worth it.
Right. Yeah, so you've not seen Lower Decks then, I guess?
Nope.
Might as well wait till Discovery Season 3 starts and finishes, and then maybe they'll have a promo and you can binge your free again.
Yeah, I don't even know if I want to watch it. I enjoyed it so little last time.
Yeah.
I really didn't like it.
Did you watch Season 2? Did you watch the second season?
Yeah, I watched the second season, yeah.
So would you watch if it was just Christopher Pike and Number One and Spock?
Oh, yeah, I might watch that.
That's coming. Yeah. That's coming up. That's called, what's it called, Jaime?
Strange New Worlds.
Strange New Worlds, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where'd they get that from?
They've got Season 1 of Discovery coming out on CBS, the broadcast network. So, Mark, perhaps a few years from now, he'll be able to catch up on all the episodes. And they're like, all right, Season 5. So we're doing a marathon of the first four seasons. All right, I'll put it in the background. It's free.
Meh.
Yeah. I got to be honest. It's not my favorite Star Trek either, the first season of Discovery. I really didn't enjoy the Klingon stuff and the subtitles. And, it was just a bit too much, right? The second season was better. But then, it's not, I don't know. I think they're trying too hard. I mean, if you look at, how the Next Generation was different than Star Trek, right? The original series, and enough that it made for compelling TV, but it was kind of stiff in its own way too. And then Voyager was an interesting take, and then Deep Space Nine was a completely different take as well, right? So, but there was this, I don't know, maybe it was because Roddenberry was still around and had some sort of direction involved, right? I don't know. I can ask Jaime about this tomorrow on Spotcast. Not waste our time on this show.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.